Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Religicide, Confronting the Roots of Anti-Religious Violence, by Georgette F. Bennett and Jerry White. Read by Jonathan Yen. Foreword by Zayd Ra'ad al-Hussein. Zayd Ra'ad al-Hussein served as the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, 2014 to 2018, and as Jordan's ambassador to the United Nations, 2000 to 2007, 2010 to 2014, and the United States, 2007 to 2010. He represented Jordan before the International Court of Justice and played a key role in the establishment of the International Criminal Court, ICC. He currently serves as president of the International Peace Institute, IPI, and a professor of practice of law and human rights at the University of Pennsylvania. This book focuses on protecting a particular set of rights, those associated with religion, our freedom to believe what we believe, and our responsibility to protect religious groups and indigenous minorities who face existential threats. This is an urgent matter for attention and action. There were historic negotiations in the 1960s to establish a UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Religious Intolerance, but they failed to materialize. To this day, those negotiations remain the most ambitious UN attempt to make religion a subject of international law. In 1960, the stage had been set for the development of a convention with the negotiation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights to End Religious Intolerance. Article 18 of this covenant is specifically worded to protect freedom of religion and belief worldwide. 1. Everyone shall have the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right shall include freedom to have or adopt a religion or belief of his choice, and freedom, either individually or in community with others, and in public or private, to manifest his religion or belief in worship, observance, practice, and teaching. 2. No one shall be subject to coercion, which would impair his freedom to have or to adopt a religion or belief of his choice. 3. Freedom to manifest one's religion or beliefs may be subject only to such limitations as are prescribed by law and are necessary to protect public safety, order, health, or morals, or the fundamental rights and freedoms of others. The authors believe this remains insufficient and argue that there ideally ought to be a new international legal instrument with a new global covenant devoted to the protection of religious minorities and their sacred heritage. After all, the earlier and unsuccessful draft convention against religious discrimination endeavored to reach much further than the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. For example, it proposed the freedom to learn about religions. In other words, the freedom to recognize that other narratives also exist. When I first was asked to consider religicide as a category of threat, the intentional murder of a religion, its followers, and their heritage, I was less than 3 months away from taking up my assignment as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. I believed that this issue merited discussion and have therefore welcomed this timely contribution by Jerry White and Georgette Bennett, whom I've known for nearly 4 decades combined. While I may not agree with them on every point, I fully recognize the extent to which these two authors are formidable advocates for interreligious engagement, humanitarian action, and social justice. Both have led game-changing initiatives to prevent violence and promote human rights. I first met Jerry White in 1998 when he led the Landmine Survivors Network. Jerry proved himself a persuasive advocate with an irreverent sense of humor. Jerry shares in the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize, awarded to the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. An amputee landmine survivor himself, he joined forces with Princess Diana during the last year of her life, escorting her on what was to be her last humanitarian mission to Bosnia and Herzegovina, a heavily mine-affected country, just 3 weeks before she tragically died in Paris. Inspired by her gift of courageous compassion, the landmine movement proved a remarkable success in terms of impact after her death, with tens of thousands of victims receiving care, tens of millions of mines cleared and destroyed in national stockpiles, and more than 160 countries joining the historic 1997 Mine Ban Treaty. Jerry and I later collaborated on other high-impact campaigns, such as the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. How many people can say they were in the room where it happened, privileged to co-create historic treaties that affected hundreds of millions of lives? Jerry White has been in rooms where a lot gets done. He was appointed U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State under President Barack Obama and used the levers of government to launch a new Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations. In government service, he wasted no time to enact innovative reforms. Within 3 years, his team of data-driven diplomats became super forecasters who outperformed several U.S. intelligence agencies that participated in government competitions to predict, with high accuracy, fast-breaking global events. Georgette Bennett, like Jerry, is friendly and fierce. Her work as a criminologist, human rights activist, and peace builder has garnered international recognition, including the OLAM Society for International Development Israel Branch Global Impact Award, Forbes 50 Over 50, and the prestigious AARP Purpose Prize, known as the Genius Prize for those over 50. Upon completing her PhD, Georgette embarked on a career that had nothing to do with religion and everything to do with crime. She expanded the role of women in law enforcement, did pioneering work in community policing, which is now practiced in countries around the world, including Jordan, successfully lobbied for the first sex crimes unit in the United States, and helped launch the victims' rights movement with the idea for the first federally funded crime victim service center. As a criminologist, she became interested in the link between religion and violence. Her late husband, Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum, was a driving force in the interreligious reconciliation movement and a renowned human rights activist. After he died in 1992, Georgette founded the Tannenbaum Center for Interreligious Understanding, an organization that works to combat religious prejudice and violence. In 2013, Georgette became immersed in addressing the Syrian humanitarian crisis and wanted to focus her efforts on aiding Syrian refugees in Jordan. I advised Georgette to consider an interreligious approach to the crisis, and I provided a private briefing to a group of select organizations gathering to launch the Multi-Faith Alliance for Syrian Refugees, MFA, in 2013. Today, the alliance is made up of more than 100 partner organizations delivering aid to more than 2.3 million displaced Syrians. Georgette revealed the unlikely story of the partnership she fostered and the geopolitical obstacles she overcame in her book, Thou Shalt Not Stand Idly By, How One Woman Confronted the Greatest Humanitarian Crisis of Our Time. With these two authors joining forces to focus on how to end what they call religicide, we are well advised to listen to their urgent call to action. Killing in the name of religion, or being killed because of your religion, continues unabated. There are warning signs everywhere that anti-religious violence is a fast-spreading threat to humanity. This timely book offers an opportunity for policymakers, activists, and diverse religious leaders to dive deeper into the underlying causes of anti-religious violence. Georgette Bennett and Jerry White call for dynamic, cross-border, cross-sector collaboration to put an end to religicide, heretofore unrecognized as a distinct crime under international law. I know from decades of professional experience how difficult it will be to expand categories of international law that cover a range of intersectional crimes, from genocide, well-defined, ecocide, recently proposed, and what they call facticide, defined as a battle for truth. Their findings will no doubt challenge governments, civil society, and business leaders who have started to think more seriously about human rights and the role of religion in economics. Building a coalition across sectors, working with faith leaders, civil societies, policymakers, and corporations, will help raise the stakes for collective efforts to prevent the proliferation of religion-related violence. This is an ambitious and hopeful proposal to mobilize a truly concerted effort appropriately led by indigenous survivors of religicide. It will take several years to build a movement to enact the hoped-for global covenant of religions to reverse current trends. That said, this timely push, including its attention to climate crises, might just deliver the sort of creative shock therapy needed to confront the systemic roots of religiously motivated violence. Defining religicide is only one of the daunting challenges we face. Then comes the hard part: how to admit our collective failings and work toward systemic reform. It is all easier said than done. Specifically, we can protect our diverse neighbors by learning how to respect those who believe and look differently than we do. We need to expand and extend protections for ethno-religious groups denied equal rights and citizenship. We need to be more than bystanders or legal analysts. We must commit to interrupting violence, not just observing it. To start, perhaps our hearts must be broken open with compassion as we watch as members of our human family, our brothers and sisters, are violated through no fault of their own. Now is the time for us to stand with courage, dignity, and respect for human rights and join in solidarity to interrupt the emergence of new strains of anti-religious violence accelerated by advanced technology and artificial intelligence in the world today. Chapter 1. A Problem with No Name. I was wandering alone among the crumbling barracks of Birkenau, part of the Auschwitz complex outside Krakow, Poland. It is a gray day. With no other person in sight, I am free to weep and to rage. It is here that my maternal grandparents literally went up in smoke before I was born. Their ashes are somewhere beneath me, layered with decades of topsoil. I felt helpless to do anything but say Kaddish, the life-affirming Jewish prayer for the dead. 20 years later, when I started working on this book, I began to explore whether my grandparents had been victims of religicide. Georgette Bennett. Looking at a map of the world, one can stick pins in at least 60 countries where there are active armed conflicts. Contemporary violence has killed more than 6 million people and displaced more than 80 million, including 26 million refugees. Behind each number is a person whose rights are being violated. Hear some of their voices. Rahim is a Rohingya high school teacher in Myanmar. I knew I was dead if I got caught. They were hunting me. They knew that I would always speak out for the people. They wanted to destroy us because they knew that without us, they could do whatever they wanted to the rest of the Rohingya. A Rohingya farmer from Rakhine State, in the westernmost part of Myanmar, lost 2 sons and 2 daughters. We must protect his name because he's still under threat. At midnight, the military come in my house and burnt the house. But first they raped, shot my two daughters in front of me. I have no words to express how it was for me to suffer, to look at my daughters being raped and killed in front of me. My two sons were also killed by the government. I was not able to get the dead bodies of my daughters. It is a great sorrow for me. Shireen, a young Yazidi girl from Rambusi village on the south side of Mount Shingal, also known as Sinjar, was forced into sex slavery. She told of being herded to a wedding hall near Shingal town with many other Yazidi families. When everybody was unloaded from trucks, ISIS sold me to someone in Raqqa City in Syria. In Syria, I was tortured. I was sold and bought as a cheap commodity for more than five times. There were hundreds and thousands of Yazidi girls there being sold as sex slaves. In 2019, the New York Times reported on 150 pages of leaked directives on how the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, planned to control its Uyghur population. These included students returning from university to find that their parents were gone, sent to a training school set up by the government. Although they weren't criminals, the parents weren't allowed to leave these schools because they had been infected by the virus of Islamic radicalism and must be quarantined and cured. A Tibetan monk living in Drepung Monastery recalls how members of the Communist Party burst in, breaking the doors and gates of the colleges and dormitories. The soldiers were armed and equipped with hatchets and hammers, as well as torches, handcuffs, and wire ropes. They would first ask for phones, which were systematically confiscated. Stephen Charleston, a member of the Choctaw Nation, laments, "In historic memory, we have seen our reality come crashing down as invaders destroyed our homeland. We have lived through genocide, concentration camps, religious persecution, and every human rights abuse imaginable." These testimonies of inhumane cruelty are not uncommon. Today, there are entire populations and cultures at risk of being wiped out because of their religion. This is modern-day extinction. While violence between states has declined steadily since World War II, there is one insidious strand of violence resurging in the 21st century: attacks against people who believe in a god. This violence is either committed in the name of religion itself, or in the name of a state or ideology aimed at eradicating a religion. Surprisingly, there is no unique law for this kind of violence. But in order to respond to or prevent a crime, we must first name it. We call it religicide. Absent a name, and absent appropriate laws and methods for dealing with religicide, it continues unabated, unrecognized, and unprosecuted. In 2015, Jordan tried to address these gaps, working with several faith leaders and religious scholars to identify significant fractures in the protection of religion and sacred heritage targeted for eradication. When the Islamic State, ISIS, emerged in 2012, countries worldwide witnessed modern religicide on fast forward. ISIS targeted all other religions, condemning them to destruction and death. In response, Jordan drafted a UN resolution that defined religicide as a systematic policy of causing unwanted immigration or displacement of a religious group, sect, or community, or divestment of its identity based on religious or sectarian motives, even if not committed in relation to an armed conflict. Jordan asserted two primary criminal acts that would comprise religicide: intimidating or threatening religious communities or groups and subjecting them to a humiliating treatment, including making them practice acts contrary to their religious faiths, and confiscating, destroying, or displacing the tangible religious heritage of a religious community or group, or otherwise depriving them thereof. The Jordanian initiative quickly came up against a Western human rights bias that favors a focus on individual rather than group rights. This first attempt to criminalize religicide also faced a perception of legal redundancy. An argument was made that this crime was already covered by international law, specifically as crimes against humanity as defined in Article 7 of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, discussed in detail later in this book. U.S. State Department lawyers concurred that elements of religicide were already covered by international laws that dealt with religious discrimination and atrocity. Both the United States and United Kingdom are permanent members of the UN Security Council and are mostly loath to recognize group rights, including social and economic rights. They did not see a need for additional legal protections, despite the growing threat of religiously motivated violence proliferating worldwide. In the end, the Jordanian draft resolution against religicide was never sent to the UN Security Council for deliberation. Consequently, the laws that address human rights violations continue to have significant gaps that allow crimes of religicide to slip through the cracks. Even those laws that could be invoked go unenforced. It is critically important to find new laws and new methods to prevent and respond to this form of fast-growing violence, which threatens billions of believers around the world. The United Nations, with its 193 member states, recognizes four distinct types of atrocities: war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing. None of these is mutually exclusive. The concept of religicide has evolved from and incorporates these other forms of human rights violations, but it has two additional hallmarks: ecocide and facticide. Ecocide is the destruction of the natural habitat, property, and homes to drive people off their land or make it impossible for them to return or survive in place. In the case of the Islamic State and Abu Bakr Naji's The Management of Savagery, the scorched earth policy fits this criterion. We see systematic destruction of the environment, including poisoned water wells and deforestation of food sources. Facticide is the deliberate and chronic distortion of truth and dissemination of falsehoods in media and education to dehumanize and incite violence against a religious group. In the modern era, religicide is accelerated through calls for mass slaughter issued through online media channels constructed for and dedicated to driving false narratives that incite dominant groups to kill a religious group as a service to humanity. In the chapters that follow, we will parse the difference between religicide and other forms of atrocities and explain the urgency of creating a new category of collective cruelty. We will examine the nightmare of regimes that torture individuals and punish groups for simply believing differently. We will explore several ongoing religicides, criminal cases in which the world can still intervene before it's too late. And we will offer a set of policies and strategies for doing so, including a new covenantal approach that taps the wisdom of indigenous peoples who align with nature in order to reduce violent conflict and promote the collective healing of survivors. Conventional wisdom in the West holds that the world is becoming increasingly secular. However, more than 80% of the world's people affiliate with a religion. That is more than 6 billion individuals believing in something bigger than themselves, associating with religious institutions, practicing faith, and professing spiritual beliefs. Religion is not going anywhere soon. On the contrary, the number of religious adherents is growing globally. The Pew Research Center projects that the world's proportion of the non-religious will shrink from 17% today to 13% by 2050. This is despite the growing number of nuns in the United States, now at nearly 30% of the population. Many of us in the United States take our religious freedom for granted, including the right to be free of religion. But consider how you might react to someone forcing their beliefs upon you, let alone punishing you for believing differently. Today, we are witnessing families and communities struggling to simply worship their God and practice their traditions without punishment, persecution, and discrimination. Religicide is the systematic attempt to eradicate a religion and its followers through forms of persecution that destroy their heritage, culture, and hope. Religicide is designed to wipe out an entire religious community. In the face of such persecution and despair, many in a target group seek to end their own lives. Suicide becomes a form of religicide in slow motion, with rising rates of collective traumatic stress, depression, and existential despair. Chapter 2: Atrocities and Human Rights Law. We believe the existing international instruments are insufficient to combat religicide. Religicide warrants its own category of law that will integrate and build upon previous laws and declarations in order to protect people who believe differently. But one must first understand the existing statutes. The concept of war crimes dates back more than 100 years. At that time, international humanitarian law was codified in the Hague Conventions of 1899 and 1907. These early conventions prohibited certain actions between warring parties. Later treaties, such as the Geneva Conventions of 1864, 1949, and 1977, focused on mistreatment of prisoners of war and direct attacks on civilians. In international armed conflicts, the conventions protect those who are not actively taking part in fighting, those who have laid down their arms by virtue of illness, wounds, imprisonment, and other reasons, as well as medics, clergy, humanitarian workers, and civil defense staff. In short, war crimes can be committed against combatants or non-combatants, but the protections are specific to actions between hostile parties during a state of war. The Syrian War is an obvious and egregious example of war crimes committed against civilian populations, and was perpetrated not by one party, but at least three: the Syrian regime, Russia, and Iran. Iran is managing the ground war. Russia is running the air war. The regime of Bashar al-Assad is driving the domestic terror campaign. As victims of all three, Syrian civilians have been bombed, tortured, starved, raped, and displaced with impunity. Attacks on medical workers and facilities have been an ongoing feature of Syrian war crimes. Dr. Osman Al-Haj Osman, a senior doctor and emergency room physician at Dar al-Shifa Hospital in Aleppo, treated civilians who had been wounded in the illegal bombardments. He attested that the Syrian government bombed the hospital six times between August and November 2012, claiming it was a terrorist hideout. The military gave no warning before the attacks, so there was no opportunity to evacuate patients and save civilian staff. Essentially, the war in Syria has become a proxy war among competing powers, the United States and Saudi Arabia against Russia and Iran. It does have a religious element, in that the majority Sunni population has revolted against the minority Alawite ruling group, but this does not meet the criteria for religicide. In contrast to war crimes, genocide is directed at an entire ethnic or racial group, generally civilians. The first genocide of the 20th century took place during...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?